All right, let's open our Bibles to Genesis 9:6, briefly. Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. The issues concerning the image of God we've already studied in considerable detail in connection with Genesis 1:26, where we learn that God created man in his own image and likeness. We will review it after we study capital punishment. We started capital punishment last time. I gave you point one, definition. When the ruling body of a society executes a person who takes the life of another unjustifiably, we reviewed the four areas of divine morality: personal freedom or volition, marriage, family, and society. Some want to try and make a fifth one, the earth, as a moral institution that needs to be, that God designed for the proper, orderly, and free function of society. But I'm not sure whether I like that idea or not, but I just thought I'd throw it out there at the time. Point two, the divine mandate for capital punishment is Genesis 9, 5 through 6. It cannot be misunderstood. It's very clear. I just read it. The means of administration can be debated and discussed. Scripture will help us there. But the divine mandate itself is perfectly clear. Point three, this is a social or moral guideline to provide freedom and stability within society. We saw three key passages: Ecclesiastes 8:11, Psalm 12:8, Proverbs 29:4, passages that are very clear in showing us that God expects the society of man, the organized and formal society of man, to execute criminals. And specifically, I only look at Ecclesiastes 8:11, because the punishment against an evil deed is not expedited, the hearts of the Son of Man are given freely over to do evil. Point four, purpose. We saw the three purposes of capital punishment: punishment, protection, and deterrent. Punishment so that that individual can no longer participate in societal blessings. He has removed societal blessings from one or more other individuals, and he therefore forfeits his right to participate in those items. Thus, a punishment factor. And notice, when we're speaking of punishment, not to make the person feel bad, but to remove from him what he has removed from someone else. You see, that's basically the definition of the first moral institution: personal freedom, the right to do, the right and the freedom to do anything you want to do, as long as it does not infringe upon the rights and freedoms of someone else. It's a very clear, simple definition of freedom. You can do anything you want to do as long as it does not infringe upon the rights and freedoms of somebody else. Now, that's from a moral standpoint. When you get into spiritual standards, then it's between you and God, and then you have something else involved, okay? But in other words, you want to get into the debate, well, I can do anything in the privacy of my home that I want to. That's true morally. Socially, from the standpoint of freedom, yes, you have the right to do anything within your home that you choose, regardless of its intrinsic morality, as long as it doesn't infringe upon the rights and freedoms of somebody else. So in other words, the government has no right to come into your home and dictate to you what you can and cannot do. And if you want to, quote-unquote, sin in your home all you want to, you have the freedom to do that. Okay.
Unless
it's infringing upon the rights of somebody else. Okay, like maybe a child in the home, or unless you go outside the home and hurt and harm other people. But as long as you're in the privacy of your own home, That's your domain. Now, when we get into Christianity, then of course, God is the only one who has a right to come into my home and dictate to me how I'm going to live. God is the only one who has the right to come into the privacy of my home and dictate how I'm going to live. And I say, God is not the pastor, not another believer. Nobody has any business sticking their nose into your house saying, oh, you should do this or you should do that. That's another part of religion, isn't it? Visiting people at their home, seeing what they're doing and how they're living. Well, why haven't you been in church for the last several weeks? As if they're really concerned. No, they just want to stick their nose in your business. I know I'm being pessimistic, but 9 times out of 10, it's a religious motivation. It's a self-righteous motivation. It is a gossip motivation. We haven't seen Joe for 3 weeks. Let's go find out what he's up to. Instead of, oh, I hope he's okay. Sometimes that will come across, oh, let's be sure Joe's okay. But you have this gossip invasion of privacy motivation that so often comes out because why? It is human nature.
Isn't it ever genuine?
Of course it is.
Do you actually care?
Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. And I didn't mean to imply that it was never genuine, but most of the time. Because see, if it was genuine, there'd be many other different ways to approach it than invading the privacy of the individual. But anyway, we'll get on to a different. Deterrent. Again, a reference to Ecclesiastes 8:11. Capital punishment that's executed against the criminal deters me from doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we saw the principle of Deuteronomy 21 where you hang the person on the tree and let them stay there all day long. And the mamas would bring their little children across and they'd file by and look up there and say, look what this guy did. And they'd have a little plaque. They'd have it labeled. This guy did such and such. See, Johnny? That's what happened when you do this. Okay?
Oh, my God.
See?
Sounds like England. They used to draw and quarter people and pin up their body parts up around town.
Well, that was the principle of deterrent. You'd think twice, maybe 3 times, not before you went and did likewise. A lot in Israel was visual. That's why you have the animal sacrifices. That's a visual teaching aid. Okay? The feast days, visual teaching aid. Dietary, dress code, all of these things are visual teaching aids. What were they required to do in their homes? They were required to put up passages of Scripture in their home. Visual teaching aids. That's the principle of a very nice passage in Deuteronomy 6. Five through nine, specifically, six through nine. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Visual teaching aids, very, very important part of Israel's life.
What's the Deuteronomy?
6, 7 through 9. 6 through 9. So, deterrent. And, I jumped, didn't I? The second one was protection. Protection of the other people in society so they will not fall under the same criminal activity as the victim. So this person will not do it again. So protection could also be, guess what? Deterrent. Huh. I just found my third P. Remember last time I was talking about making it nice and three P's? Well, deterrent could be prevention. So there you got your three P's and you've got a perfect little sermon. Excuse me. Punishment, protection, prevention. Okay. Point number five is where we left off. As a moral policy designed by God, capital punishment functions as a fulfillment of man's need for personal vengeance. Fulfills man's need for personal vengeance. Okay, let's amplify that. A, first of all, for the unbeliever. This is the person who functions on moral standards. He has no spiritual standards. Remember, morality was designed by God for the entire human race, not for Christians, but for the entire human race, in order to provide security, stability, freedom within that society. Morality, in providing that freedom, provides also for a free dissemination of the gospel. Where freedom is eroded, removed, then you have a hindrance to the communication of the gospel, to the overt or public communication of the gospel. Obviously, you cannot, it depends on the nature of the enslavement, how much a person can or cannot talk.
So it was really established by God for the
freedom, for the stability and freedom of society, for all members of the human race, for the human race as a whole. And see,
and then the moral laws also open the door for...
Yeah, freedom. When freedom is preserved, then this ensures the free dissemination of the gospel. Or unhindered, you might say. Unhindered dissemination of the gospel.
But not necessarily unregulated. I mean, it's regulated today. I mean, you can't proselytize in various areas.
I suppose there are certain regulations that are in place.
On a bus.
But that, I don't know that there's a regulation against it. If you wanted to sit down next to somebody in the bus and talk to them about the gospel, what would prevent that?
Never stop
me. Yeah, well, right. I don't think. There is a moral principle and a spiritual principle that meld together there, and that is that as a believer, I have no right using my employer's time to promote my faith.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not being morally responsible in a business relationship. So, in other words, on company time, I should not be imposing my beliefs on somebody else. Making arrangements elsewhere, you know, lunch breaks, after work, before work, something like that. But as far as taking away from neglecting my responsibilities in order to promote my faith is wrong on my part, and the employer has all the rights in the world to come down on me about that. And I can't say, oh, religious persecution. No, because I'm at fault.
What if a co-worker asked you to pray with them or for him?
Then what you do is you understand, first of all, the principle of prayer and say, okay, Joe, I'll pray for you right now. You go back to work, I'll go back to work. I've already prayed for you. It's done in my mind. See? Remember, religion thinks prayer is something formal where you have to sit down, bow your head, hold hands, and pray out loud.
Yeah.
That's a religious formality. Prayer is done silently in the mind. Okay? Sure, there's such a thing as public prayer and group prayer. That's fine. But when someone says, pray for me, say, it's done. You know, you just say, all right, I just did it. You're prayed for.
However, we know that works. But the person that we are praying for may
not, and so that may require some explanation.
It's obvious that they require more of an assurance.
That means you have to teach them. That's a perfect opportunity to teach
they
them.
Require a performance.
They may require performance. They need teaching is what they need. And so you need to explain to them that I've prayed for you. But you have to be certain, not that does not interfere with your moral duties on the job. Say, or just say, yeah, I will. Well, will you do it right now? I say, no, I won't do it right now because we have work to do. I'll meet with you in 20 minutes at lunch and we'll sit down and pray.
Then you have to be in fellowship.
Of course, right, certainly.
You know, there are times, and I don't do it often, but at work when I realize God opens a door of opportunity for me to pray for someone or to speak a few words. And I mean, it is company time, but I figure it's God's time.
Now, are you talking to someone?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm a patient.
Okay, are you a nurse?
No, I'm a secretary.
Oh, okay, okay.
It would be easier if I were a nurse.
Right.
But we also are required to enter a certain amount of interaction with the patients.
Right.
She's been called on it before.
Yeah.
Well, not in a long time.
Yeah. You need to use discretion.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do pray about it.
Yeah.
And Lord, if there is an opportunity or
you
desire, and I need to know that it is your time and your will.
Right. But remember that you can accomplish it in an instant.
Yes.
Okay.
Realize
that. Right. And as far as ministering to the other person, you can keep it brief, you know, and it's probably no issue. It's when this starts to infringe upon duties, and if it has been done in such a way that it has got your employer's attention in the past, and they, you know, were kind of disgruntled about it. Time is not the issue. I'm just talking in principle. Well, then I have to realize. Well, now, okay, maybe I need to do this differently. You know, and since it's, and on the subject, you have the subject of school prayer, okay? This so-called outline of school prayer, it's impossible. They can't outlaw school prayer. They can outlaw a formal, verbal, overt prayer, okay? And the Christians should not be all excited about that. You see, we shouldn't be imposing. And so much of this stuff is religious anyway. I'm happy because most of these prayers are all religious and don't have any real spiritual meaning anyway. So I just assume not them. They not be verbalized. You know, the true Christian understands that he can pray all day long in school. You know, and it not be an issue. Yeah.
I agree that
Paul used to say he mentions people in their prayer, in his prayer. Mentions.
Yeah.
Elaborate this.
Well, right.
Yes.
Okay. So for the unbeliever. This policy only works if it's utilized by society. The policy of capital punishment, providing fulfillment for personal vengeance. It only works if it's utilized by society. only works if utilized by society. This is the principle of Proverbs 20:28. Which I think we may have looked at last time, but loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness. Loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness.
My version says mercy and truth. Is it a New King James?
Grace could be a good word there. not mercy. The Hebrew word is kesed, which means grace, provision. And in this context, in association with truth, grace has to do with the moral provision from God. God designed and provided morality, so the king follows that design. And also associated with that is truth, which of course is integrity and honesty. So by following the moral design that God provided, so loyalty in the New American Standard kind of communicates that. Loyalty to the moral principle, okay? And truth preserves the king. Keeps him in place, keeps him functioning properly. And he upholds his throne, how? By righteousness, which is the very same word, by the way. If your translation is consistent, you'll have mercy there twice.
Loving kindness.
Okay, well, they just translated the word kesed, mercy the first time, loving kindness the second time. Most translations are inconsistent. See? It's the same word both places. And it means grace provision, not even loving kindness, which is a common translation. But he upholds his throne by the observation of this moral design. That's how he upholds his throne, and how he preserves freedom within his domain, is by following the moral design, which is represented by the word C-H-E-S-E-D. Kesed means grace provision. Usually, it's what God provides for the believer. But it really means anything God provides. And in our context, God provides morality, the moral design, which of course is for unbelievers as well as believers. There, by the way, is a moral conscience in all members of society. In all members of the human race, rather, there is a moral conscience that is built into the soul. A moral design that is there from birth. It's part of the soul. It's not something that is taught. It is a design or pattern or format that is there by the design of God. That's the purpose of proper child training is to confirm that design, to stabilize that design so that it will be functional in that child's life as he develops. Okay? If this child is not taught a confirmation, then his sin nature is going to go the pathway of least resistance, which is self-centeredness, and that moral design will be violated. Now, this all sounds well and good, and someone said, well, show me that in the Bible. I say, okay, well, we'll have to show you that in the Bible then. You have two passages. You have Ecclesiastes 7:29, and you have Romans 2:14. We'll look at these since it's important to understand. Review for you. You're familiar with that. Ecclesiastes 7:29, right after Proverbs. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. The word upright there is Y-A-S-H-A-R. Pronounced Yashar. Ecclesiastes 7:29. I should orient you a little bit to my Hebrew. I use a transliteration system that is not going to be totally consistent with what you might see in several of the books, because I like to give you a phonetic accuracy, which is difficult to find. So I will use a capital A for the ah sound. Yashar. Yeah, well, you're looking at not the vocabulary word, but the text word, and that's different. Okay, you're looking at the form. The form in the text is totally different from a vocabulary word. This is a vocabulary word. Okay? Like in English, what is the boy was beginning to grow. What is the vocabulary word in English for beginning? What would you look up in the dictionary?
Starting.
Origin.
No. The vocabulary word for beginning. The boy was beginning to...
What would we look up?
Yeah, the boy was beginning. Now, I'm looking at the word beginning. The boy was beginning to... What did I say? Grow up?
Grow up.
Okay, the boy was beginning to grow up. Now, we're looking at that word beginning. It's a verb, right? Mm-hmm. What is the vocabulary form? What would you look up in the dictionary? Beginning?
Begin.
See? You'd look up begin. And one of the... like began. Okay, the boy began to grow up. Let's use that one instead. The boy began to grow up. Would you look up began in the dictionary? No, you wouldn't find it, would you? You'd find a begin. Okay, so that's what you're looking at. You're looking at a form of the vocabulary word. The vocabulary word is yashar.
I'm looking at the translucent.
Right, of the form in the text, which is not the vocabulary form in this case. Okay. So anyway, the capital A is the ah sound, the small a is the a sound, but you don't have to worry about that until we get to something like that. But we'll be seeing a lot of Hebrew as we make more progress through the Old Testament. It will become more and more significant, and you'll start becoming familiar with not only pronunciation, but some of the technicalities of it too. Okay, just as you've done with the Greek, as we've done various studies in the Greek. Yashar is a word that is consistently used for moral uprightness. Translated goodness, translated rightness, sometimes translated even righteousness, but it always has to do with morality. The word that has to do with spiritual integrity is the word righteousness, which is a different word, and it has double meaning. But yashar is consistent. Yashar always has morality behind it. So it says here that God made men yashar. He made men upright. Morally good. God made men morally good. That's the sole design. But what is in man? Sin nature. What does the sin nature do? Seeks out many devices. Okay? But the design is uprightness. Look at Romans 2:14. And you may recall that we are studying Romans on Monday nights, and we, although we are at Romans chapter 7, we have been at chapter 2 before, so we studied this already. 2:14, for when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively, the Greek says do by nature, phusis, they do, phusis. They do by nature. So phusis goes back to Ecclesiastes 7:29. God made man upright. God made man with a particular nature, didn't he? Upright. Mm-hmm. Did God make man with the sin nature?
No.
Sin nature was inherited from the parents. And then we can get into some details as well. When does this... It developed. What is the sin nature? It is a what? Remember the word? Mutation. Sin nature is a mutation of the mentality genes. When Adam rebelled against God, it caused a physical mutation in his brain cells. That's the sin nature. Sin nature is not in the soul.
Now where is that? Explain that it is a mutation in the...
It's explained by comparing a variety of passages.
So it's a mutation in the brain?
Right, of the brain cells, right.
Mutation of the brain cells.
Right, the mentality.
Is it because it was the very first sin that it developed a mutation from having a wedge through a pure mind?
Yeah, you could say that, not necessarily because it was the first one, but because it happened. But I mean, it just so happened that the first one doesn't mean that every time someone sins after that, see, every sin after that won't cause a mutation, because the mutation already exists. In fact, the sin it results from that mutation, but it can do damage to the neuro the neurotransmitters, and it can also do physical damage. And all of this is going to cause an adverse reaction on the soul itself. Remember, the soul is itself not a sinful entity.
Okay. Where did Adam get the sin nature?
It developed. It happened. When he sinned, this caused a mutation of his mentality. That mutation is the sin nature.
Okay.
Okay.
A mutation of... Well, that's interesting because it aligns right up with the psychiatric study of the human.
Except that psychology and psychiatry do not recognize the sin nature.
Too bad.
Yeah. That's why Christian psychologists are all wet, because they try to approach it from a secular standpoint instead of saying your problem is the sin nature. Not psychology, not psychiatry, it's the sin nature.
Well, and that's why it's so difficult for them to see it, because they see it. There is an aberration in the brain cells. And in fact, the medications, you know, have the ability to bring the brain to transmit again.
Only to control
a certain
not to deal with the sin nature itself at all.
In fact, this one psychiatrist is much closer to it, I believe, when he says there is no such thing as a free lunch. I mean, take your medication, but don't expect it to do all the work for you.
Resolve all
the right.
Resolve
right.
Everything for
well,
you.
Well, I go as far as knowing the metal, though, and I speak to that. It's not your fault because they are in. Bad. They came from something that they developed somewhere along the line that had influenced them to become a criminal or whatever you want to call them. I don't call them criminals. But.
I just wonder, Ron, did the mutation come before or after or at the time when God put the hammer down after the sin?
No, it happened when they sinned. When they made the decision to sin, that caused the mutation. See, God did not make the mutation happen. The mutation happened when they sinned.
But it was an effect of what caused?
Their choice to reject, to go against standard inherent principles of truth that were built into the soul. When they violated those, that caused a mutation of the mind,
that
of the brain.
That must have been one heck of a tree then.
Well, no, it wasn't the tree. It was the act.
Well, yes. Yeah, I know, but...
The tree was harmless. The tree was harmless. We've been there before.
Yeah. The woman you gave me did it.
Yeah. No, it was the snake.
It was the woman. Adam even said that.
Back
this woman you gave me.
Yeah, I know.
But the,
and that still persists.
You talked earlier about capital punishment, but this is a fulfillment of man's need for personal vengeance, which Adam, you know, blamed, you know, they were, it was a contest of sorts.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you with me? You know, everybody's blaming everybody else.
Yeah.
It's not my fault.
Yeah, Bob did, and he said it was the snake's fault.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone was pointing the finger.
Okay, so.
Not funny.
Okay.
At 2:14. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively, that's the New American Standard Translation, the marginal note says by nature, and that's the word P-H-U-S-I-S, which is the word nature. They do by nature. What do they do by nature? The things of the law. Since these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, and it's used in a good sense there, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. End parenthesis. It's a complicated passage. I don't want to go into too much detail. This is the sole design that's there. Ecclesiastes 7:29, you want to put that in the margin. And at Ecclesiastes, you want to put Romans 2:14 in the margin so that you have reference to that. But it's very clearly stated, they do by nature. These are unbelievers, aren't they? These are unbelievers, and they do by nature what? The things of the law. But they also have another influence in there, which is 729b of Ecclesiastes, which says, but they have sought out what? Many devices. That's the sin nature. Now, how do we know that the sin nature is a mutation of the mentality genes? We know it by comparing several principles. First of all, we would look at Jeremiah.
Jeremiah.
Yeah, I'm looking.
17:9.
Right. Now, the heart refers to the mentality of the soul. This is describing it from the standpoint of the effect that the sin nature has on the heart, which makes it sinful, but not addressing the issue of whether the heart itself or the soul itself is sinful. You see, the soul is created by God, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, the body is created by a law that God put into operation, the law of procreation. Okay, so the body is created by inheriting genes from parents. So God didn't directly create our body of sin. It's produced by a process that God put into operation. But God created the soul and placed it into the body at birth. Controversial, but just go with it. Yeah. Yeah. But he placed it into the body at birth. The body, as soon as the two seeds, the sperm and the egg, join, boom, you've got a developing human being, a human body, that has inherited genetic codes from parents, including mentality genes. And where's the sin nature? In the mentality genes. So, see, that's why you get it from your parents. And that's why a lot of times your sin nature tendencies will very much fall right in line with your parents, one or both. Okay?
God states it, and he says he will punish.
Right. And that's only indirectly related to the sin nature.
To the third and fourth generation.
Right. That's only indirectly related to the sin nature. That's more specifically has to do with the function of the sin nature, not the dissemination of it, but more the function of it. And it doesn't you see, you don't have to follow in the pathway of your parents. You just may have a tendency to follow in the pathway of one or both of them. But you always have a choice, especially as a believer. But when we get into the four-generation curse of the passage you were just referring to, it's a whole other story. And we could be going here and there and on all kinds of different tangents forever. The heart is more deceitful than all else. We have three words here that describe the sin nature: deceitful, sick, and who can understand it. The word deceitful speaks of error and falsehood, should be obvious. Deceitful, falsehood, error, contrary to truth. Desperately sick. Sick speaks of distortion and abnormality. This is not talking about Well, it is. It's talking about any kind of sickness. Any kind of sickness is a distortion and an abnormality. If you have a cold, that's not normal. Mm-hmm. That's an abnormality. Well, this is talking about something that has influenced the heart so that it is now desperately sick. Well, that's distortion and abnormality. Ecclesiastes 9:3 is what I want. Yes. Ecclesiastes 9:3. So don't lose Jeremiah. We still got to talk about something else. But Ecclesiastes 9:3, and you need to put that in the margin if it's not. It is. In the New American Standard, you have Ecclesiastes 9:3 right at the top of the list there. 9:3 says, "This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanities is in their hearts throughout their lives." Afterwards, they die. 9:3. Insanities is in their life. Well, insanity goes back to Jeremiah 17:9, desperately sick, or what? Abnormal. The function of the sin nature is insanity. Sin is insanity. Usually, from the human standpoint, we think of insanity simply as an extreme mental condition.
Mental
but
aberration.
Yeah, but any time a person violates a standard of God, that is insane. It is insane for the creature to go against the Creator in any way, shape, or form. Teeniest, largest, whatever. Whatever the degree, it doesn't matter. It's insane to go against the Creator. And that's what the sin nature does. The sin nature is what? Independent. That's the operative word for the sin nature. It is independent from God. Thinks, functions, acts independent from God. And influences us to do that as well. That is basically what sin is. See, there's two ways to define sin. You can define sin as a violation of God's righteousness, but you can also define it as independence from God. Because that's exactly what it is. So, the heart is more deceitful than all else. That speaks of its, from the standpoint of error and falsehood, desperately sick. What kind of sickness? Distortion. Any sickness is a distortion. So this is telling us that the sin nature is a distortion. Who can understand it indicates the personal frustration that is there. How can we, you know, Paul expressed this frustration in Romans 7, which we'll look at in a moment, where he says, "What I do, I don't understand, for I do what I don't want to do, and I don't do what I want to do," and we'll look at that shortly. So that's the concept expressed there in Jeremiah 17:9. Who can understand it? It causes a frustration for the one who wants to please God. Because here I want to please God, which is what Paul says in Romans 7. I want to please God, but there's something else happening in me that's causing me not to please God. And that's the presence of the sin nature. And whether it's a believer or an unbeliever, it is a frustration, it is an insanity, and of course it is falsehood.
We must be cautious not to do that, because we have a personal issue, a penalty for any sin, whatever level we might assign to it.
Right. There's two, you know, we get into consequences. There's all kinds of levels of consequences. There are self-imposed consequences. There are natural consequences. There are societal consequences. There are divinely administrated consequences. And so you got four just right there alone. In connection with this, the principle that we find at Isaiah 14, no, not Isaiah, Ezekiel. 28. And Ezekiel 28, right after Jeremiah. Okay. Ezekiel 28, 17. Now, I'm going to tell you something about this passage that you're just going to have to accept by faith at the present time because I don't have time to go into it. But 28:11-19, Ezekiel 28:11-19 deals with Lucifer at the time of his fall. It extends beyond the human ruler mentioned, King of Tyre, and extends in what I call a prophetic flashback. It takes us back in time and is describing now something that happened to Satan. And again, the proof of this is comes in the analysis, and I won't go into the details, but no, it's 11 through 19. But I want to look at 17 because this is describing what happened when Lucifer sinned. What happened when Lucifer sinned? Well, you know that Lucifer was created perfect, right? So when he sinned, he expressed independence from God. He violated the standards of God's righteousness. What happened to his makeup? What happened to his mentality?
It mutated.
He got a sin nature. Satan has a sin nature. All the fallen natures have sin natures. Fallen angels have sin natures also. Here it is at 17. Your heart was corrupted because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. What wisdom? The perfect wisdom that God created him with, the perfect intellect, but he corrupted it. Okay, so we have terms of corruption, insanity, aberration, abnormality, sickness. See, all these speak of something that was not the way it started out. Thus, the term mutation. Because it's not a good thing. Mutation is bad. Okay. And then to establish once and for all that the sin nature is in the body and not in the soul, we go to Romans 7. Through 24, which is what we've just recently been studying on Mondays, which is why we...
Would you give that reference again?
Yes, Romans 7, 14 through 24. And we will look at a few of these verses to establish... Paul uses two terms... to describe the sin nature. He calls it sin with a definite article, the sin, and he also describes it by the word the flesh. Okay? He does not call it the flesh here. He uses the word flesh here, but he does not call the sin nature the flesh here. This is the basis for him using the term flesh to now refer to the sin nature, which he begins to do in chapter 8. Okay, so let's look at verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of flesh. Is that wrong? Is that bad? No, of course not. He is. He's of flesh. But because he's of flesh, which means he's a physical being, he is sold into bondage to the sin. Definite article has to be placed in front of sin there. The sin.
See, my version says sold under sin.
Okay, that's fine. As long as you have the, you got to put the sin in front, the in front of sin. I know, because no translation will recognize that the is there in the text. And why is it there in the text? Because it's specifically referring to the nature of sin. So it's the sin, and Paul does this consistently with the word sin. Okay? So he's sold into bondage to the sin nature. The word nature is not there, it's implied. And you'll see in the passage how this is clarified. So he's saying, I'm a physical being, and because I'm a physical being, I'm sold into bondage to the sin nature. Now, that's not the way God created it. When God created Adam, Adam was fleshly also. But at that time, fleshly did not mean the presence of a sin nature. It was not until after he sinned that the sin nature was acquired. Now fleshly, or of flesh, means plus a sin nature. So when he produced a son in his own image, that was the image of God plus the image of Adam. Two things. The image of God was passed on, which we will study later. The image of God was not lost when Adam sinned. Some people teach this. I don't know if you ever heard that. Some people teach that the image of God was lost when Adam sinned. You know, but it was not. But when Adam sinned, the human being was altered. Now there's something else there that is in addition to the image of God. Mm-hmm. And that's the sin nature, right. So anyway, at 7:15, he now goes on to explain this. For that which I'm doing, I don't understand. There's that concept of frustration which we saw at Jeremiah 17:9. For that which I'm doing, I don't understand, for I am not practicing what I want to do, but I'm doing the very thing I hate. Now, let's understand what Paul's saying. Oh, by the way, this is when Paul's a believer. This is not talking about Paul when he was an unbeliever.
Right.
This is talking about something he's going through right now as he is the apostle. He says, I'm not practicing what I would like to do. This is looking at it from the standpoint of a believer who wants to please God. General attitude, encouraged from the moment of salvation by most Christians who have some kind of follow-up by the person who led them to the Lord. They develop an attitude, I want to please God. But I'm not pleasing God. Why not? Something's happening that's stopping. I really want to please God, but boom, I try and then do something else. That's what Paul's talking about here. And he says, it's something I hate. I'm doing something I hate. Verse 16, but I do the very thing I don't want to do. I'm sorry, but if I do the very thing I don't want to do, I agree with the law, confessing that it is good. The law represents moral and righteous standards. When Paul does something and he says, I hate what I do, well then he's saying, because I think the law is right. So when I violate the law, of course I hate that. And by contrast, I am agreeing with the law that it's good. I'm saying the law is good because when I violate it, I hate that. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying the law is good. Verse 17, so now, no longer am I the one doing it, but the sin which indwells me. You see, it's a nature, isn't it? It's not talking about a sin, it's talking about the sin. So he's saying, it's not me who's doing it, it's the sin, definite article, put it in front of the word sin. And regardless of how you or someone else want to interpret this phrase, sin, you've got to have the word the there. Okay, if someone can somehow rationalize and say, no, it's not the sin nature, and some do, some don't accept this idea of the sin nature. Regardless, you have to put the there. You have to show that it's at least there in the text. Okay, the sin. So no longer am I the one doing it, but the sin which indwells me. He's not denying personal responsibility. He's trying to explain what it is that causes him to sin. This is not advocating, I'm not responsible. The sin nature did it. Oh, I didn't steal that. The sin nature stole it. I didn't kill that person. The sin nature did it. He's not advocating that. This is from the standpoint of the believer who wants to please God. From his attitude to please God, no, he's not the one who did it. Because he's operating from a want-to perspective. But the sin nature takes over and causes him to sin. It's not denying personal responsibility. Continuing. Notice, at the end of verse 17, the sin which indwells me. indwells me. Well, where does it indwell? Look at the following verse. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. Where's the sin nature? In my flesh, in my physical body. For the wishing is present in me, but the doing of the good is not. For the good that we won't go into that. It'd take us a long time to explain, but let's move on down to 20. But if I am doing the very thing I don't wish or want, I am no longer the one doing it, but the sin which dwells in me. He repeats himself. I find then the principle that the evil is present in me, the one who wishes to do good. For I joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man, in the soul. See, there's the contrast between the inner man and the flesh. Notice, verse 22, according to the inner man, and verse 18, in my flesh. Inner man versus flesh. Sin nature is not in your inner man. The sin nature influences the inner man, but it's not in the inner man. Sin nature is not in your soul. It's in your body. Where in your body? In the brain cells. Not in your toes, not in your fingers, not in your physical heart. It permeates the brain cells, every single brain cell. That's why you cannot separate, medically speaking, the sin nature from the rest of you. They will never be able to, you know, where they find this particular gene causes such and such, and this particular part of the DNA, they will never be able to separate the sin nature. Because it permeates every single mentality cell that you have. And they can't even identify it. Why? Because it's the natural structure of man. Verse 23, but I see a different law in my members of my body waging war against the law of my mind. You see here, members of my body, law of my mind. Mind versus body. Mind versus body. And then Paul's going to develop this in more detail in chapter 8. And that's why we're studying Colossians on Monday, because he's talking about how to find a victory over the sin nature. Okay, well, that was an important review for us to understand why it is we should view the sin nature as a corruption of the mentality, a distortion, a mutation is a good word as any, of the mentality genes that has a direct influence on my soul. You see, the soul, as I mentioned last time, the soul is dependent for its function on our human body in this life. In this life, the soul is dependent upon our human body. Okay, that means the soul is dependent upon the brain, mm-hmm. Not our toes, but the brain, the physical brain. The soul is limited, therefore, in its expression because of the natural limitations of our brain cell, of our brains. And, of course, you know what science has said all along, that we use only, a tiny portion of our brain. Mm-hmm. Okay, if we used more, then the soul would have a greater capacity. Okay. Well, in our resurrection body, there will be no limitations. We will use to full capacity our brain. Okay, and it'll be a new brain. Remember, new body.
And you don't have to be afraid.
That's right. And there will be no mental retardation. There will be no genius versus moron, because everyone will be functioning fully without physical limitations. Why is there a retardation now? Why is there a moron now? Why is there someone who is the educational level of a fifth grader or the age level of a three-year-old? Because of something that's happened to the brain cells. Okay? Some kind of birth defect. and that limits the function of the soul, because the soul is dependent upon the physical body. Once the soul leaves the physical body, it leaves that limitation behind, and so it will function fully.
Yes, there will be a really happy
place. Ah, yes.
Mm.
Let me think where we... Oh, okay. Return to Romans 2, and we'll finish up at Romans 2. For when the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature or instinctively. King James, I think translates it by nature.
What verse is this?
2:14. Okay. So we were talking about the natural design that is in every member of the human race. And society, beginning with the parents, will cultivate that. Will cultivate that. If that cultivation does not occur, then the sin nature is going to be the dominant factor. The whole purpose of morality is to restrict the overt expression of the sin nature in order to provide freedom and stability to the human race. You can add that to the basic definition I gave you of morality, which is to provide what God designed to preserve the stability and freedom of society. Well, it also, how does it do that? See, I just told you that's what it does, but how does it do that? It does it by restricting the overt expression of the sin nature. Morality does not change character. God's moral design is for overt issues. The unbeliever does not get a change of character. But his old sin nature can be restricted, can't it? By society that follows morality. And by a design that there says, no, harming someone else is not right. I feel this, I know this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Because I want. That's the sin nature. So the sin nature ignores the freedoms and rights of other people in order to promote my own agenda. Well, morality is designed to restrict that a little bit. So in all four areas, personal freedom, marriage, family, and then the social structure. And if these things are followed, then yes, the overt expression of the sin nature is hindered, and you have a stability and freedom in society.
I grew up very bitter towards my mother, but I see now that she was restricting me from probably a lot of things that I could have gotten into.
Yeah, it's the way some of these things are done, okay? Mm-hmm. And if a child is taught early on properly from a good, healthy Christian environment, then they will understand what's going on. But see here's a problem. Another subject, but when you train children, you guys are beyond that, I think, but when you train children, you don't just tell them, do this. You teach them.
Right.
You're teaching them, why do this? And what is the question that always comes out of the child's mouth? Why? Well, tell them why. Explain it to them. And you start from the very earliest age teaching them why. So this is why you do this. This is why you do that. This is why you do something else. This is the way Israel was functioning. This is the way God taught them to function. Okay? When they taught their children. This is why you do A, B, C, D. Okay, let me give you one last point that really needs no explanation, just the statement. Point one, under A, the policy only works if it's utilized by society, right? Okay, if society doesn't utilize it, then what's going to happen? Point two is what's going to happen. Otherwise, revenge anarchy will occur. Otherwise, revenge anarchy will occur. Everyone taking the law into their own hands. Somebody hurts me, I'm going to hurt you. Somebody hits you, you hit them back. Somebody calls you a name, you call them a name. Somebody shoots your cat, you go shoot their dog. Revenge, personal revenge, anarchy. If society does not practice proper administration of morality, of the moral design, then revenge anarchy will reign. Revenge anarchy.
Isn't Paris is what, the eighth day of riots now?
Say again?
Paris.
The country of Paris.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
That's anarchy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's all right, and there's several levels of anarchy, okay? Personal, personal, societal.
It seems to have erupted.
Personal anarchy is you within yourself rebelling against everything that is stable and moral. And it can, of course, extend beyond the personal to others. So next time, we will look at how Israel dealt with this need for personal vengeance, which is a bona fide need. It's acceptable. I should have a right to avenge the death of my daughter, the death of my son, or the murder, I should say, murder. We're not talking about normal death activity, but the murder or the theft of something or the rape or whatever it is. I should have a right to get some kind of justice. If society doesn't do it, then I have a right to do something about it. Well, we'll talk about this. It's called the doctrine of the blood avenger. And in connection with that is also the cities of refuge. So that we'll pick up there next Sunday. And I won't review as much.